Let's go tonight to Revelation, the last part of chapter 13, to begin. Remember in Revelation chapter 13, you've got two of Satan's actors. You've got the great world dictator coming on the scene, which we looked at in 13, 1 through 10. And then second, you have the false prophet that comes on in 13:11 through the end. The first one is a civil power. The second one is a religious power, and we have just a little bit more to finish out with the false prophet, chapter 13:11 through 17. We had his appearance in verse 11. I saw another beast because of his ferocious anti-God attitude. Coming up out of the earth is often a word used for Israel. This could mean Palestine. And he had two horns like a lamb. And the lamb, of course, contrasts the other beast, who is like a leopard and a bear. And therefore, the lamb is the idea of helpful to humanity, religion. However, he spoke like a dragon. So the interesting thing about verse 11 is the total disparity between appearance and words. His words are the devil. His appearance is a lamb. We shouldn't be surprised at that. That's always Satan's method to appear as an angel of light. Then verses 12 on through the following through 17 emphasize his power. We looked at two of them last time. First of all, his power, it is derived. And that's found in verse 12. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. So it's derived from him. Second is an emphasis that it is superhuman. It is derived, it is superhuman. And that can be seen in verse 13. He performs great signs or miracles, so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs or miracles which it was given to him to perform. He is superhuman. Third, and this is where we stopped, is a remark about his power is sinister. And that is found in verse 15. There was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of beast to be killed. So toward those that hold to the truth, his power is exercised in a sinister manner. Finally, focusing a little bit more on the nature of his power, it is economic. Verses 16 and 17. Verse 16. And he causes all, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, and the free man and the slaves. Notice the polarization in verse 16. When he talks about the rich and the poor, where is the middle class? You've got it polarized. Now, it is true that there is a figure of speech and language called a merism. And merisms is where you state extremes to get the whole. If you want to emphasize that you looked everywhere for something, you say you looked what? High and low. That's a merism. And while that is true in verse 16, that is including everyone, yet at the same time you do find in the book of Revelation a polarization of the extremely rich on one side, extremely poor on the other. Could we make any observation on that as far as current history is concerned? One of the significant classes, at least in our country, that is shrinking is what? Middle class. Going to either poor on one side or rich on the other. And it is interesting, I think, that when you come to the book of Revelation, you have that kind of polarization. Where that's rich or poor, the in-between simply are not envisaged at all in that book. Now notice also, coming down to verse 16, he causes all, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on the right hand or their forehead. Remember, in our last study, we emphasized how all of this is an infernal trinity that copies the eternal trinity, how there is an imitation of the real. The fact that the followers of the beast have a mark, what might that well be imitating? Go over to Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians 1. And it could well be that he is imitating with his counterfeit mark, marking those that are his, the mark that the Lord has for those that are his. Coming down to chapter 1 of Ephesians and verse 13. In him, referring to Christ, you also, after listening to the message of the truth, the gospel of your salvation, having also believed, you were sealed. In other words, we had a mark with the Holy Spirit of promise who was given as a pledge or as a mark of our inheritance. So it's very well possible that the counterfeit continues right here into the mark. All right, with that then, we close out chapter 13. Verse 17, he provides that no one should be able to buy or sell. Notice absolute economic control. Except the one who has the mark. And at that point, you could well ask, how could you so totally control buying and selling? And we could make all kinds of suggestions. A plastic card society could do it. Probably no one sitting here has not presented your card for payment at a store, MasterCard, Visa, something of that sort. And as you know, you are checked out to see if you can buy or cannot. And it may not make any difference how badly you want to buy. The computer will tell you whether you can or you cannot do so, depending on what your limits may be. And so you could easily see this coming about in a simply cashless, you hear talk about it, cashless society, where you only buy with certain identifying marks, which could be on a card, on a forehead, something of that sort that is readable. And that is as feasible as it can possibly be today. Then finally concluding, here is wisdom, verse 18. I think it's very interesting that in the book of Revelation, for those that find themselves in this period of time, there is always something they can do. Here's what they can do. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man or man, and his number is 666. I'm not going to say much about that verse except to emphasize that by means of a mark of some kind, there is an absolute economic control. And I think you've probably been, probably read in the last 5-10 years, how many people can tell you who 66 is or what 66 is, anything from a computer to who knows what, and really nobody knows what that is, totaling up names by their numerical value, all types of things of that sort. We do not know. I assume that verse 18 is written for those are there when it happens, and they will be able to identify such at that particular time by some obvious means, but I think it's really precarious try and interpret that ahead of time, except to say a mark will control whether or not you can sell or buy. All right, now chapter 14. Chapter 14, and let's make some introductory remarks about it. Introductory to 14. The first thing to note is this. 14 brings the material of 12 and 13 to a conclusion. So let's put it, it is a conclusion to chapter 12 and 13. The sequence has been chapter 12, the focus on the place of Israel in this great tribulation period. 13 is a focus on Satan's agents. And with that focus on Satan's agents after chapter 12 and 13, we now need to stop and realize something. Because chapter 13 is as dark as a chapter could possibly be, with defeat, with the rise of the two beasts, with the universal worship of Satan, and you have a tremendously dark passage, probably one of the darkest, if not the darkest, in Scripture as far as human history is concerned. Isn't it appropriate, then, that chapter 14 presents the ultimate victory of Christ? Or, let's put it this way, chapters 12 and 13 are concluding chapters of human history. Chapter 14 is the final chapter of human history. In chapter 12 and 13, you have the end of man. In chapter 14, you have the end of God, making the final chapter and bringing everything to a conclusion. So we need, again, in 14, to keep the action on hold and take a look at what is there. So this is a conclusion, then, to chapters 12 and 13. One other note about what is in chapter 14. The material, and let's make that a second point of introduction, the material in chapter 14 is not chronological. It's thematic. The material is not chronological. In other words, the action doesn't move. It just says, now, down here, I'm going to narrate what is going to happen as though it has already happened. I'm not going to try. We'll get chronology moving again when you get in chapter 15. But we're still on hold. The material is not chronological, but thematic. Or think of it this way, if it's easier to think in this term rather than chronological and thematic. Chapter 14 is a snapshot. It is not a movie. It's not moving things on. It's giving you four snapshots side by side that will go in a different direction. Chronological motion picks up with the next chapter. Second point, then, of introduction. It is not chronological. It's thematic. Third point. Well, no, that's enough. That's all I want to say by way of introduction. So let's go then and see the three parts of chapter 14. Part 1 centers around proclamation. Chapter 1 centers around proclamation, chapter 14, verses 1 through 7. Proclamation is the emphasis. Verse 1, and I looked, and behold, a lamb, notice he's proclaiming fact, was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of thunder. Get the idea of proclamation here? And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. They sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they are celibates. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. So the first proclamation, then, is going to be of final victory of Christ. And the proclamation of the final victory is found in 14, 1 through 5. Now we'll spend some time with that. Probably the rest of our time tonight we'll spend with that particular proclamation. But let me go ahead throughout the rest of it. When you come down to verse 6, you see another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach. So notice we're still proclaiming. So proclamation of final victory. Second, proclamation of the eternal gospel. Fourteen, 6 and 7. The next summary word that we can use to put the chapter together is a divine pronouncement. And the pronouncement is found in verses 8 through 13. 14, 8 through 13. Verse 8, and another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. So in the pronouncement, we'll have two things pronounced. One, pronouncement of judgment. Or judgments, plural, verses 8 through 12. And the judgment that is pronounced on two classes. First of all, it is a pronouncement of judgment on Babylon. We have not dealt with Babylon yet in Revelation, but this will be important. Is this overhead making you seasick? I know it needs to be chalked up here just a minute. If it isn't you, it is me. I just don't focus that. Okay. Pronouncement of judgments, first of all, on Babylon. That's verse 8. Then in verse 9, another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead upon his hand, he will also drink of the wine of the wrath of God. So judgments on Babylon, and second, on followers of the beast. Can you see how this is all chapter 14 bringing us to a conclusion, bringing us to an end? In chapter 13, the followers of the beast have wonderful freedom. They can buy and sell as they will. Isn't it great? That's the concluding chapter of man's history, but it's not the final chapter. And chapter 14 dovetails real nicely to say, now wait a minute. We left some things dangling in chapter 13. It looks like everybody followed the beast, doesn't it? They didn't. It looks like those who followed the beast had it made because they could buy and sell as they would. What freedom! But that's not the final chapter. We want to get to the final chapter because their great freedom they think they have to buy and sell is going to be followed with a glass of wine that God is going to say, you're going to drink. And the drink is going to be the wrath of God pictured in 9 through 12. There is another pronouncement, and that's in verse 13. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. So you have a pronouncement of judgment and now a pronouncement of blessing. Notice the note of righteousness and justice that comes about under the reign of Christ that you don't have under the beast. Under the beast, you have idolatry. Under the beast, those who will follow him in his sin and idolatry are blessed. Those who refuse to follow him do not receive blessing, but they are put to death. And where does that leave us? That leaves us with an unrighteous, unjust situation. So what do we need? We need Revelation 14 to say now, all those that have sinned have had great freedom and blessing under the beast. Now, at the hands of God, things will be made right and they will receive judgment. And those that have been killed under the beast, Christ returns, and now, for those who deserve blessing, blessing will be there. And this is, again, the theme song of the prophets. Is you have injustice, unrighteousness in human history until the Messiah comes. And when the Messiah comes, he establishes peace, prosperity, righteousness, justice, on the earth. All right, that's our second block then of chapter 14, our third. Our third is a preview. 14:14-20. Verse 14. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud that is associated with the return of Christ. And sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came up out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. And from there on, like down in verse 19, the angel swung his sickle to the earth, gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth, and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. So you're going to have then, finally, a preview, and the preview will be a preview of Armageddon, the great battle of history, the final rebellion of man against God, to which the return of Christ responds. So then let's mold our chapter about two proclamations, verses 1 through 7, two pronouncements on two different classes, the execution of judgment on those that have followed the beast and those a blessing on those who have not, and then we're going to get a quick, candid shot previewing the Battle of Armageddon. The whole chapter is proleptic. Proleptic means you treat something that is sure to happen as though it has just happened. That's not at all unusual for the Bible to write proleptically. How about Isaiah 53? The Lord, all we like sheep have gone astray, the Lord has laid on him, notice the tense, has laid on him as though it had already happened, the iniquity of us all. And that's a reference to the cross, which is future. Well, why do they do that? It's the proleptic view that this thing is for sure, so let's narrate it as though it has already happened. And this is the way you've got to look at Revelation chapter 14 as being that way. All right, now let's go back and pick up on some details. First section, Roman numeral 1, proclamation. 14:1-7, and our two parts to it, is proclamation of the final victory. 1-5. And the first thing, in order to see, and this is the one point I want to try and make now in the next 6-7 minutes, is this, that chapter 13 is a concluding chapter. Chapter 14 is the final chapter. Now let me approach it from this angle. Revelation chapter 14 answers some of the questions that come out of chapter 13. Revelation 14 answers some of the questions that come out of chapter 13. And I think I'll associate the questions by a reference in chapter 13, and then second, we'll put down what the question is, and third, how chapter 14 answers it. So first of all, a question from Revelation 13, verse 15. And then under that, what the question is, and second, how chapter 14 answers the question. This is looking at chapter 14 of pulling together the conclusions that we ought to come to, of showing that chapter 14 is the final chapter, of which chapter 13 is a concluding chapter. All right, first of all, in chapter 13 and verse 15, there was given to him, that is this false prophet, to give breath. The word is pneuma in Greek, that means spirit, and it can simply mean not necessarily to give life. I think if you've got King James, you've got life there, don't you? Okay, the Greek word for life is zoe. This word, breath, is pneuma. And it means spirit or breath. in the sense of animation, that was given to him to give animation to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause. Notice this is an image of some sort that is created that it's an animated image of some type. Again, only the wildest speculation. But an image that can speak, that can move, that can act and do things, and it's animated, would make you think down what line of technology today. Down along the robot type thing. And of course, as you well know, many years ago, what you have pictured with a robot? This clanking metal thing whose arms would, you know, do like that in jerky motion. But production, and I don't have the latest on that, but production, is robot production being done in our country? Is that being done on a serious scale? I think I've bought a couple of cars that were put together by something that didn't have a brain. But nonetheless, I mean, making a diesel out of a gasoline engine. Guess who did that? Nonetheless, and I bought one. So from 13:15 then, you have the following. There was given to him breath to the image, some kind of animated mechanical thing. And the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now, that ought to raise a question. What about justice? What about the saints that are killed? Is that the last chapter? Does the beast have the last word? What about these killed saints? Is that the last chapter? Is that it? Is that where the narrative ends? With the beast slaying God's children? If so, what about justice? Well, chapter 14 says, I want to answer that for you. And so we go over to chapter 14 and verse 13 for the answer. Heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. And we get to that, we'll explain it. I take the now on is during this tribulation period. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. Chapter 13, verse 15 is a concluding chapter. Chapter 14, verse 13 is the final chapter. And the important thing to note there is God writes it. The beast and Satan write chapter 13. God writes chapter 14, and that's where it is so beautifully put in the book of Revelation. All right, second question. Then, coming out of Revelation 13, 12, and 14. Reading 13, 12. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And he makes the earth and those that dwell in it to worship the first beast. Now, the tone of that is very universal, isn't it? The tone of that is that everybody is deceived from that. So the question would be, are all men complete victims? Is there no chance? Look down at verse 14. He deceives those who dwell on the earth because the signs which was given to him performed in the presence of the beast. So the question would be, is the deception total? Is the deception total? Or is there any opportunity for salvation? For that, let's derive our answer from 14, 6, and 7. Because along with the deception of the beast is the truth of God. Chapter 14, verse 6. And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on earth. So we've got the beast in 13, 14 deceiving those who dwell on earth. But notice there is truth in verse 6 for those who live on earth and to every nation, tribe, and tongue, and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God, give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water. So in chapter 13, it looks like the deception is total and there is no truth around. Well, at that time, that is a concluding chapter, but it's not the final chapter. And parallel to the deception of the beast and the lie is proclamation of the eternal gospel. Can you see how chapter 14 fits? It's bringing us to conclusions off of especially chapter 13. All right, our third question comes from Revelation 13 and verse 14. Verse 14 says, "He, this false prophet, deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which was given to him performed in the presence of the beast." Now, the question that comes off of this third area right here is simply this. This false prophet in chapter 13 is totally successful, isn't he? He succeeds in doing what he wants to do. So the question is this. A false prophet has misled. Is there any judgment for him? So is there judgment? We certainly don't see it at the end of chapter 13. Is there judgment for the false prophet? And you would naturally ask that. You come to the end of chapter 13, and you cannot answer that from the end of chapter 13, can you? From the end of chapter 13, someone asked that question, you'd have to say, well, I guess not. There's none stated. However, we have an answer to that in chapter 14 and verse 8. Another angel, a second one, followed saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And we'll associate that as we come to these verses with the false prophet and with the great world dictator. "She who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality," and then you have them drinking of the wine of the wrath of God in the following section. Number four, and this is a question from Revelation 13:16. Chapter 14 showing the final end of chapter 13. Verse 16. It says, "He," that is the beast, "causes all, the small and the great, the rich and the poor, the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead." And of course, this is to indicate whether or not they can buy or sell. So the question would be, is there judgment for the great world dictator? And the answer to that is found in Revelation 14. Our answer comes from Revelation 14, 9 through 11. Verse 9. "Another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he will also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark of it.'" So we have judgment poured out on him. And finally, our fifth question comes from all of that chapter 13. And the question is, will rebellion be allowed to continue? Definitely rebellion is allowed. Up to this point, if you say, will rebellion be allowed? The answer is yes. But we've got to add a word. Forever. Will there be a day? And the answer to that comes from chapter 14, verses 14 through 20. So the relationship then is Revelation 14 is a reminder that God is sovereign, and though he permits rebellion, he writes the final chapter. 13 is man's culmination. 14 is God's culmination. Now notice that in Revelation 13, you can really write over that one word, the word ecumenical. One dictator, one religion, one worship, one worldism. If you're going to look at it from the political or civic viewpoint or civil viewpoint, and if you look at it from the religious viewpoint, the whole thing is ecumenical. One world thing. I got an interesting thing in the mail today that I thought I'd share with you. And Deschardin, French philosopher, the heading of this, it's on the letterhead, it's on the envelope of this organization called The Future Is Now, and they take from Deschardin, and his quote is, "The future of the earth is in our hands." Obviously a humanistic approach to things. You can't really debate that that is true, but it's false. If you would answer, how do you feel about this statement, the future of the earth is in our hands, answer that from Revelation 13. Is that right? Really, from the standpoint of the extent to which that's true is answered by Revelation 13. The extent to which it is not true is answered where? By Revelation 14. And let me see if I can give you a little bit of the content of this. This is a global event now. And all I want you to get from this is the ecumenical, totally ecumenical attitude. I have never seen an organization, I don't know how tightly organized it is. It's located in a box here in Kansas City, but I believe there is an address. I have never seen an organization with as widespread, the advisory committee is everybody. I mean, you got lawyers, you got doctors, you got from this education. Of course, it's naturally loaded with preachers. You've got Jewish rabbis, you've got Catholic theologians, you've got Protestant leaders, you've got, I've never seen, you got two city councilmen in Kansas City, Missouri that are involved. I've never seen such a pulling together of everything. It even has some businesses that have nothing to do with that. It even has one of the leaders in the Westport, the Prospect in Westport. I think it's the Prospect. But I've never seen such a plethora. And I, you know, you look through that and you're like, now who is doing this? Is this a movement among the churches? Is this a movement from the legal profession, from the medical? And the only answer to that is there is no pattern to it. All I can say in looking through the names listed, it's everybody from every walk of life, which is interesting. At any rate, we're going to have a global event, and we at Beth Haven have been invited to join it. On December 31st, 1986, from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, people around the world will join in thought and spirit, visualizing our world as peaceful and harmonious. The primary purpose is to raise the consciousness of the world so that people will live productive, fulfilling lives. The idea of a global event began with John Price of Austin, Texas. That figures what comes out of Texas is. Founded a planetary commission to unite people in a common bond with a common goal, i.e., peace on Earth. Price has this to say about the planetary commission. It is our opportunity as individuals and as a world body to begin to heal and bring our planet back into harmony and balance. As far as I'm concerned, there is no competition involved in the healing and harmonizing of planet Earth. No conflict of philosophies should ever keep us from supporting one another in this endeavor. What's that saying? There is no doctrine that should ever get in the way of what? World ecumenical peace. That's exactly what he's saying. As far as I am concerned, there is no competition involved in the healing and harmonizing of planet Earth. Our objective is to have 500 million people simply consenting to the healing of the planet, with no less than 50 million coming together in a global mind link. Sound spacey? Sounds satanic. The underlying belief is that mass consciousness can be shifted by aligning a small percentage of the world population. And here you've got countries committed to World Healing Day. There are 40 committed cities, Denver, Houston, Seattle, Tucson, Corpus Christi, and so forth. And Kansas City also has a committee. This will meet at the municipal auditorium 6 o'clock on that day this year. Then for those who are athletically inclined, on September 16th to December 31st, 1986, hundreds of thousands of runners will participate in a 25,000-mile marathon relay, carrying a torch through 39 nations to dramatize what can be accomplished when the nations cooperate. The torch will arrive at the United Nations 12, Mean Time, Greenwich, December 31st, and be used to light an eternal flame. The event is scheduled to be covered on Worldwide TV. David Gershon, the editor of the first Earth Run, was invited to China to meet with supporters of the run. He's received a commitment for 1 billion candles, 1 billion candles to be lighted in concert with the lighting of the eternal flame at the United Nations building, the culmination of the first Earth Run. And then a letter heading, "The Future of the Earth is in Our Hands." And it is signed, these are all local people, signed by a local rabbi, signed by a local Episcopalian lady priest, signed by another lady, I don't recognize her, and then signed by Father Norman Roter, I suppose it would be pronounced. And there it is. It's the kind of attitude that you're seeing. And you can see how the ecumenical idea, man is going to write the final chapter. And I think it is so interesting that we've just looked at his final chapter, chapter 13. Won't the people find a great surprise at the end? All right. Now let's take chapter 14 and relate it to the timeline that we have worked on. When you go through Revelation, remember, there are times when there are flashes back to the past. We had, was it not in chapter 12, a flashback to Bethlehem, the birth of Christ. We had another flashback to the fall of Satan. There are also references to the present. Now, how much space I put on this timeline has nothing to do with the time. It's just sequence of events is what I want you to get. Followed by the return, the removal of the church, the rapture. Church out, 1 Thessalonians 4. Then you have this tribulation period with a mark, you know, in the middle, 3.5 years, 3.5. Followed by the final rebellion of man, or Armageddon. And then the return of Christ and the establishment of his kingdom, or the millennium. And then the new heavens and the new earth. Now, when you come to Revelation chapter 14, let's place these events, the three of them, relative to this timeline. See if you can do that. Beginning in chapter 14, verse 1, "And I looked, and behold, a lamb was standing on Mount Zion." And we'll spend a little time establishing that Mount Zion is in Jerusalem. And so you have a lamb reigning from Jerusalem. Where are we going to put ourselves as we start? The first event is right here at the beginning of the millennium. That's 14, 1 through 5. Then the scene of verses 6 and 7, where the eternal gospel gets proclaimed, would be over here, giving men opportunity to respond to the gospel, 14, 6, and 7. Revelation 14 is not chronological, it's thematic. It is not a video, it is a snapshot laying out the theme that there will be opportunity during this period of time, and emphasizing that there will ultimately be established on the earth peace, and it will come about by the reign of Christ. Revelation 14:8, the destruction of Babylon, comes a little bit farther down toward the end of this period. So 14:8 also is there. And it's important to note that while in chapter 14, verse 8, you have the remark saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. This, again, is proleptic. It's going to happen. Hasn't happened yet. If we want to see, you know, where does it happen? We're going to come up now with the last seven bowls of God's wrath being poured out. And with the pouring out of the seventh bowl is the destruction of Babylon. Go over to the actual event, chapter 16, across the page. About verse 17. Under this final bowl, we have these words. The seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, "It is done." And verse 19, and the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and the Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce fury. Fierce fury. Hard to say. Okay, so what is proleptically stated in chapter 14 is historically carried out down in chapter 16, and that is right down very near to the return of the Lord. Then, in 14, the event of 14, 14 through 20, which is a, we'll put it here, which is the Battle of Armageddon, 14, 14 through 20. All right, that starts us then now into 14:1, and I think I'll stop at that point because it's a good breaking point, and we'll begin next time with the 14th chapter. From here on, we'll break it into three parts. The scene, 14:1, the song, 14:2 and 3, and then finally, the saints, 14:4 and 5, are there. Interesting things in the passage that we'll get to. You look at verse 4, for example. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they are celibates. And here is an enormous lesson in how important it is to take a passage relative to the times at which it was spoken. What is verse 4 teaching? If you're married, you are what? You are defiled. Is that the biblical teaching on marriage? Is that the picture? Why would there be such virtue associated with not marrying in this particular period of time? Well, we'll find out a couple of things. Number one, we'll have to decide whether this is meant to be a literal type thing or whether it's meant in a spiritual sense of purity. We'll also note that there is a principle in Scripture that there are times when marriage is not wise. Jeremiah, for example, was directly told, don't marry. And the reason is because your children will be slaughtered because of the times. And the emphasis is, because of that, at that particular point of time, marriage would not be wise. You've got 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul recommends a remaining single, and he says this is wise for, quote, this present distress. So he's simply saying that marriage and children is pretty much relative to the times that you're in. Can you think of another thing about marriage that in this particular time that Jesus spoke in Matthew 24? Talks about woe to them who are with child in these times. And he's going to emphasize that the freedom of movement will not be there to flee. The pretty certain death of the children will be there, and therefore it is not a time to have children. And so we can come to one of the principles of family life in the tribulation. And that is, don't have children because of the nature of those particular times. And it shows that is certainly not a principle for the church age. As a matter of fact, Hebrews 13 will come right head on in collision with Revelation 14, verse 4. And we'll want to harmonize that and see how important it is to interpret each verse in the proper times and in the proper setting. Certainly the words to Adam, be fruitful and multiply, are hardly applicable in the tribulation because of the nature of the events. We'll pick up with that and try and answer that question and deal with it in our next study in Revelation. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word and your truth. May we be aware of the final culmination of events as far as man is concerned, and we are so deeply grateful that we have Revelation chapter 14 that says, whatever happens in chapter 14 at the hands of men will be corrected and set right by Jesus Christ himself in chapter 14. And so we're thankful that the ultimate chapter of final history is written not by man but by you. And we are grateful that in patience you allow rebellion, and yet the day will come when it will be all over. And we pray that because of this, knowing the final chapters, we will be able to read our signs, read our times with more intelligence in Christ's name.